You are listening to Talk To Me.
What is up, everybody? Welcome into Talk To Me. This is episode 243. As always, I am your host, Joshua Toomey. And the guest this week is the great Michael Alago. He is on to talk about his new book, I Am Michael Alago, Breathing Music, Signing Metallica, Beating Death. It will be out March 25th. Pre-orders are up now over at Amazon. Michael Alago is best known for working with Metallica, White Zombie, John Lydon, Cyndi Lauper, Nina Simone, Metal Church, and the Reformed Misfits with Michael Graves. We talk about all of that and so much more on this interview, so let's get right into it. Let's talk to Michael Alago. All right, guys, we have Michael Alago with his new book, I Am Michael Alago, and so many great things in the Netflix documentary. Who the fuck is that guy, correct? Did I get the name right on that one?
Yes, the movie is called Who the Fuck Is That Guy? The Fabulous Journey of Michael Alago, and the book is actually called I Am Michael Alago, Breathing Music, Signing Metallica, Beating Death.
Yes, and I read the entire book last night and finished it up this morning.
Oh,
and
my God, you're a great soldier.
Well, it's one of those things I was like, well, I'm going to go through it and I'm going to grab some stuff and, you know, act like I read it. But as I started to kind of just sift through it, I just kept reading and I kept reading. And you've lived a life of like 100 men. Each chapter is its own story that one person, if they had just one of your stories, would be the life of a party, would be able to tell any of those stories, but you have an entire book full of them, and I'm assuming an entire lifetime more of stories to tell.
I do. So where are we beginning?
Well, let's begin with kind of how the book starts out. And, you know, the one thing that caught me off guard or
yes,
I took to the most was, you know, you were going to concerts, you were running around, your mom had a little pact with you that if you kept your grades up, you know, you could come home whenever, but as long as you kept your grades up. So I'm just imagining a kid running around New York City in the 70s had to have been absolutely insane.
Well, it was insane because here I am, a youngster, just graduated from high school. I graduated a little early. So I graduated in 77. I was 17, but I was actually going out late 1975, 76, when I was 15, 16 years old. I looked like I was 12 and a half. No one, back in the day, they didn't card you at these clubs. Like, I would go to CBGB on the Bowery, which is like my home away from home, and Hilly Crystal, the owner, would look at me and say, "You can come in. If I see any alcohol in your hand, you get like a 2-week suspension." So what did all of us do? We got our six packs and our liquor. We brought it to the back of the club in the alleyway. We would open up the door to the alleyway, chug a few things, close the door, and none of us had alcohol in our hands at CBGB. But it was a trip. And, you know, yes, I don't know why my mother allowed me to do this. She had some kind of faith in me that everything would be okay. And it wasn't about like you can come home anytime, but as long as you did well in school and kept your grades up, you could go out. And I explored the city like nobody explored the city. I was out all the time, and I went to where the music was taking me. That was the point of going out. Find the music and just get there.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, growing up, I grew up in Nashville. We, you know, when I was in high school, we were, my dad would allow me to go to Atlanta 4 hours away to go see concerts at the Masquerade down there and go, and then that was in the 90s. And now that I'm a parent and I have kids that are in their teenage years, I'm like, how does any parent ever like let them just roam like that? I never, on school nights, my dad would let me go to Atlanta as long as I made it to school the next day. It's crazy stuff.
And just think, the world today, with all its gentrification, if you live in a big city, was way different back then. In the 70s and 80s, the Bowery was scary. It was dirty. There was crime. And you know what? I did not even think about that. All I thought about, with all my bravado and my little green knapsack with my Minolta camera, I would just put it on my shoulder, get on that B train from Manhattan, Brooklyn to Manhattan, and I would explore. And most of the time I was at CBGB, and when I was done there, I would head up to Max's Kansas City. I would walk about 10 blocks and see a show there. And then as a couple years went by and I was just a tad older, I was looking for where the after hours were, and I explored those, and I was out all the time. I don't know how to explain my life, except that I loved that I was able to witness and hear all of these great bands in their like early stages, you know, playing small clubs. Eventually that led to me saying, I want to be in the music business.
Yeah. All of those small bands that you got to see in those clubs in the 70s and stuff now are selling out, you know, on reunion shows, like the Misfits doing Madison Square Garden. And
which is the strangest thing in the whole world.
Were you able to make that show?
I went to a bunch of them. I saw them in Vegas. I saw them in New Jersey. I saw them at Madison Square Garden. And I know I saw them somewhere else. But talk about freaky. Talk about like unbelievable. Because we were seeing them at CBGB. We were seeing them at Max's. And we were seeing them at Rock Hotel. And all these places, what? They held maybe 200 people would show up in the early days, you know, 300 people. And now they're playing to 18,000 seats in Madison Square Garden. And it's a show and it's selling out. I guess that's what happens when people love you and you stay away for 15 years. You come back and you get to play Madison Square Garden, which doesn't happen all the time.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the trend now of bands to have one or two seminal albums go away. You know, even a band like My Chemical Romance, they only broke up in 2013. They haven't been away that long, but you would have felt like they were gone for 20 years the way that the fans have reacted to them coming back around.
Well, isn't that wonderful for them?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, it really is.
Well, let's kind of dive ahead. I mean, I know everybody's seen the documentary on the Netflix and everything else with kind of your upbringing and you getting into music and things. And another guy that just wrote a book, you know, Johnny Z, has been on the show before. And, you know, the one thing about you kind of coming in and seeing Metallica, I'm assuming Ride the Lightning was about to come out or had just come out when you saw them.
Well, how I saw them is me and my friend Phil Cavano from Monster Magnet saw Metallica initially in 1982 at L'Amour in Brooklyn, 7 blocks away from my house. I'm not in, I'm in the music business because I had just started as the assistant booking director at the Ritz, which everyone knows now is Webster Hall on East 11th Street. So it's 1982. I'm thinking I want to book them at the Ritz, and we go see them at L'Amour in Brooklyn, and it kind of blew me away. So fast forward, I quit the Ritz, and in 1983, I start working as an A&R executive at Elektra Records. I got the job. I had no idea what even A&R meant. I mean, really, I was lucky, I guess. And, you know, I had a conversation with the chairman about music from back in the day, the Great American Songbook, to what was happening in the 70s and 80s, and he gave me a job. He had pure trust that I guess I would do a good job. So I see Metallica in 82. I'm loving them. John has now become a new colleague of mine. And we're talking because he has a little label called Megaforce. And he has an Anthrax record, a Raven record, and a Metallica record out. They were totally independent. They couldn't do with those bands what somebody like I could do because I was part of Time Warner and a major label. So I hear all those records. John wants me to sign Raven because he thinks they're going to be the biggest band in the whole world. I said, well, you know what? I like the record, but you know, let's do a demo deal. I gave them $5,000. They gave me back 5 terrific songs. But the problem was I had just heard Kill 'Em All. And I thought, this will change not even my life, everyone's life. I lost my mind when I heard that record. So the abbreviated version of all of this is that John was furious when he learned that I didn't want to sign Raven and I wanted to sign Metallica. But, you know, it all gets worked out when money talks, and the band knew that they needed to go somewhere else in order to keep growing. You know, they needed the money. They needed a major label. And that's where I came in. And so summer of 1984, I signed them the night I saw them at Roseland in New York City. They came to my office the next day. Our chairman, Bob Krasnow, met them. And I felt like from that day, they never left my office. So it all gets worked out financially. And they're now on Elektra Records. And John and I have remained friends and colleagues over the years. And, you know, he did his thing and I did my thing.
Well, I think in the book and on some interviews I've watched with you and stuff, you talk about that you gave your business card to Lars at a show and said, hey, you know, next time you're in New York, let me know. I'll bring out the entire record company, things like that. Mm-hmm. A couple of years go by. Lars calls you up and says, hey, we're coming to New York. Mm-hmm. So kind of the narrative that you stole Metallica from Megaforce is kind of squashed there, because it actually looks like Lars, being the businessman that he is seeing that there are bigger things out there too.
That is correct. But I think it's like an inappropriate word, stole, that you just mentioned.
Right.
It wasn't really like that. I just gave you the abbreviated version, but stole is not right. It's business. And at one point, I did let John know that I did want to sign them. So at some point, when I just started my job, I knew they were playing the Stone in San Francisco, which is what you just brought up. And I thought, these are four wildly charismatic guys on that stage, and they need to be on Elektra. So, of course, Lars, being the businessman that he is, and he was the only one I spoke to in the early days mostly, I gave him my business card. And I said, if you come to New York, please give me a holler. And like, they, you know, listen, they're like 21 years old. I'm 23 years old, you know, denim, T-shirts. They look at me like, this can't be the guy from Elektra, but I was. And when they knew they were coming as part of a triple act bill to New York City with Raven and Anthrax, he called and said, will you come? Are you still interested? And I said, absolutely. And then there's the story that I just told you, that I went backstage. I said, you have to be in my life. I want you on Elektra. They came to my office the next day, and everything got worked out.
Obviously, you know, Ride the Lightning is already recorded. It's about to come out.
Yes, it is.
And
that's right.
So with kind of jumping ahead.
It came out briefly on Megaforce, and then we picked that up immediately.
And I think one of the deals Megaforce got in the deal was that they got to have their logo on their.
I love that you asked that question. Yes, they had their logo, I believe, on the first three records, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe so.
And then, you know, they made money on those two or three records in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. So everybody in the end was happy.
And in a kid like me that got into Metallica in the early 90s goes mm-hmm. back and they see the Megaforce logo on those records. And then they explore Megaforce. So, yeah, it definitely helped out everybody.
Oh, absolutely.
The first major album that you are start to finish with Metallica is still considered probably their masterpiece, which would be Master of Puppets. And I'm assuming, you know, what was it like getting those early demos or being around mm-hmm. them, getting that album together, being mm-hmm. the A&R?
Well, you know, when I first met them, I knew that these were four guys who were driven. And in talking to them in the early days, whether it was at a show, eventually in the conference room at Elektra, I knew that they knew exactly what they wanted to do with their lives. I felt that they knew exactly the type of material they were going to do, and they didn't want help from anyone. So now they are managed by Q Prime Management, and Q Prime were like, you know, we love you guys, but they want to be left alone. So, of course, we're spending the money, so they can't really be left alone. So how it all mostly worked was Lars would call me at Elektra, and he would send me cassettes of parts of songs. And that's how we just kind of talked through Master of Puppets, because they really knew that they were putting this record together on their own with no help from a label. And they were that, as young people, they were that smart that they just knew what they needed to do, you know? So it really, you know, I think I might have gone to the studio once or twice, but like I said, it was mostly back and forth, whether it was, I don't know if it was DATs at that point, but I think it was cassettes that I would get from Lars, and I would hear parts of songs, and I'd think to myself, oh my God, this is sensational. So then I would call him immediately, blah, blah, blah. And so that's how it kind of worked with that record and the records after that. I think the only time I got to hear the entire record was when I went over to George Marino at Sterling Sound, and I had the record mastered there. And then once I had it mastered, I'd call Cliff Bernstein and I would say, I just got the record mastered. Are you coming over? And he would come to my office and we would both sit there with, you know, the volume on 10 and listen to Master of Puppets. So that's how that all happened. That specific.
Wow. I couldn't even imagine sitting back and hearing Master of Puppets for the first time before anyone's heard it in a mastered state.
It really is, as we all know, such an extraordinary record. That took them, as great as Kill 'Em All, my favorite is still Ride the Lightning, as great as And Creeping Death, oh my God, what a song. As great as those records are, once you heard Master of Puppets, you knew, okay, this is going to blow up. This is going to take them over the top. And then, of course, it's 1986, and so many things start happening. You know, the record is selling. They go on the road with Ozzy. They're in Europe. And then, of course, that infamous accident happens in September of 86, and it kills our beloved Cliff. And It was awful, you know. I remember getting that phone call from Cliff Bernstein on a Saturday morning, and he said, I have terrible news. And he told me the news, and all I could do, I was like stunned, and all I could do was pace back and forth in my living room the whole day trying to take in what happened. Now, remember, everybody is so young, and can you imagine that happening in, was it Sweden, in the middle of the night?
Yeah, that entire story is insane, even with the drawing of the cards to where it could have been Kirk. Yeah. And that whole,
Right, like who was going to sleep with?
In that bunk. And
That's right. You know, we don't know about what our time is on this earth. Anyway, that's what happened. So I think I answered those questions so far.
Yeah, and anyone that's heard the show knows that the entire reason I ever picked up a bass as a kid was Cliff Burton. So
how wonderful!
So as someone in the circle there, the family circle of Metallica, kind of give us like maybe one quick Cliff Burton story to kind of lighten the mood.
Well, you know, I didn't see them a lot because they were on the West Coast. I was on the East Coast. So whenever they did shows that were mostly East Coast based, whether it was the tri-state area, Boston, Connecticut, you know, Staten Island, Long Island, and occasionally I'd go out to the West Coast. You know, Cliff was lovely. He was funny. He had a great sense of humor. I would always nag him about those elephant bell bottoms he would wear. And you'd be like, Alago, fuck off. Just get me a six pack, please. And I just loved him. I think for me, even in those early days, which were the only days he had with the band, he was the most seasoned musician for me. I thought, wow, this guy is totally brilliant. Now, as wild and crazy as the other three members were, and they were great players, Cliff was extraordinary. And, you know, it's amazing. And I guess partially it's that thing about dying at an early age when you are great. And everyone to this day still wonders and asks themselves, what would have become of him in 2020. You know what I mean? We'll never know. But thank goodness, thanks to technology and YouTube and video, official Metallica videos, we get to see Cliff at Day on the Green. And
oh, God.
Just, oh, please.
What a show.
You know, all of these if you, you know, you couldn't be there, thank God for technology and YouTube and Google and all this stuff. You just Google this Metallica 77 and something awesome is going to pop up. So wait, is Talk to Me just a, not just, but is it a metal podcast?
Yeah, it stays in the metal and hard rock vein.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, great.
But that's what was great about the book, and even on that topic, was a lot of the stories about Metallica and things like that. I've heard those my whole life. So the things that drew me in were the Nina Simone stories, or just all of that kind of world that I'm not 100% into. But I think that, you know, all of those stories about, you know, just the black artists that were getting screwed over by money and all that stuff. So that stuff was even fascinating, and that's what drew me into the book even more, was the photographers and the artists.
Well,
and things
she was at a very early age, and I don't know if you want to use this or not use this, whatever. We're just talking now. You know, I loved music from the minute I came out of the womb. And I used to watch all these music shows on TV. And those music shows had a variety of types of artists, from Grand Funk to Aretha to Bowie, you know, and the list goes on. So I learned about popular music, a wide variety of popular music, at a very early age. And I just came to love a wide variety of music. So at some point, my Aunt Jenny, when I was 12 years old, would play Nina Simone, and I thought, oh my God, this is like the craziest, greatest voice I ever heard. It had an androgynous feel. At first, I didn't know it was male or female. And then I just started picking up all her vinyl, and I thought, and she really kind of sort of became my favorite artist ever. So, you know, it's like when you don't say, for instance, you're reading the book and you don't know about Nina Simone, again, the beauty of technology and YouTube, you could go there and click Nina Simone 1965 or 1988 or whatever, and you could see, like, oh yeah, I may not love this person, but I see and feel the magic of what she does on stage. Which for me, she was just the greatest artist ever.
And the great thing about technology, too, is the fact that I was able to listen to her album that you helped with today. You know, I listened to pretty much half of it, a little bit over half of the album today, you know, as I was, you know, getting ready for the interview and kind of going around the house. So, yeah, it was, so, yeah, it's just fun stuff, man. And it's cool to,
because
at first I wasn't exactly 100% sure who she was. And then, you know, you click like the most downloaded song on Spotify and you're like, I know who this is.
What was it? Feeling Good?
Yeah, it's Feeling Good by like a wide margin.
I mean, but what a song.
Absolutely, you know? Yeah.
What a song. And what an interpretation of that song by her. It's killer, you know, absolute killer.
It is. Well, let's dive into I got a couple of bands I want to touch on, and then I'll let you get on with your day because I don't want to keep you too long.
Go ahead.
Another huge band that you signed was White Zombie. And
seeing
some of that early White Zombie stuff and the footage and things, I'm like, where did you hear a song in there that kind of drew you in?
Well, you know, it's funny because a lot, whether I'm talking to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, whether I am doing an interview for my documentary, my friend Daniel Ray in the 80s, Daniel Ray is a producer. He used to write for the Ramones and Iggy Pop, and he played in Masters of Reality. Dear friend of mine. And funny enough, that's who I was hanging up on, as you called. Friend, 39 years. And in the 80s, he shopped in three bands, Circus of Power, Raging Slab, and White Zombie. Rob Zombie might tell you a different story than I'm telling you, because I think he seemed to think a lot of labels were interested in them. No one was interested in them. So Daniel brings these three bands to, I don't remember, I think Wendy Goldstein or someone at RCA. They said, "Hey, we want to pick up Circus and Slab, but we don't want that band, White Zombie." So Shauna, the bass player, Daniel's talking to her, and she says, "Well, tell me more about that guy that you're friends with at Geffen Records." So he said, "Well, why don't I just bring him to a gig?" So he brought me to a gig in a room that I speak about in the documentary. It was just a small room that was underneath a restaurant. It was black, and you thought, like, what's going on here? And they were in the corner in the back, you know, playing a version of music that I'll just call noise. And like I've said all along, I've never heard a song. But again, There was something so wildly charismatic about Rob Zombie on that stage, even at the very, when it was just a germ of an idea, that I just thought, oh, I think I love this guy. And I, the dreadlocks and the sweat, and even at a very early age, how he related to the couple of people in the audience, I just found it fascinating. So then after the show was over, I chatted them up. I thought they were the loveliest people I've ever met in my whole life. And then we became friends. They would come over to my house for, what's that white drink? We would put it in a blender. Not pina coladas, because it had a lot of alcohol in it. Anyway, they'd come over to my house for drinks. We would sit on the floor, watch movies. And I said, you know, I have to sign you to Geffen. And so we made a tape, a demo tape with Jim Thirlwell. He's a solo artist who goes under the name Fetus. Like, you got fetus. Yeah, you got fetus on your breath. A fetus uberalis, fetus under glass. He makes a demo. The demo's fabulous. He has an ego. Rob has an ego. It doesn't work out. So now, fast forward, we have to think of who we want to produce the record. We happen to love what Andy Wallace did with Slayer, and we knew we wanted that overall sound. So we get Andy Wallace to produce that first record, and I don't know, I guess we could say, in this abbreviated version, the rest is history.
The rest is Beavis and Butthead history, right?
Oh, well, okay, there you go. So our record stalled at 180,000 units around that. Under 200,000, and everybody in our next marketing meeting at Geffen are like, okay, Lago, what are you going to do now? Because the record ain't selling. And really, it was a confluence of things that very day, week, month, that the next thing you know, Beavis and Butthead are in love with White Zombie, and they start playing Thunder Kiss 65. Not only at 5 o'clock in the morning when people are sleeping, but morning, I think they played it morning, noon, and night. And that really was the thing that catapulted that record to a million units, at least.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the more ingenious things Rob ever did early on was when he was painting the Headbangers Ball set. And I think it took him like an entire season to paint it, which probably would have taken him, you know, maybe two or three episodes. But he knew He knew that he was going to be on tons of episodes of Headbangers Ball if he just, you know, kind of slowed down and did it right.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Another smart cookie. He knew what he wanted from the get-go. And, you know, look at him now. He makes his horror movies. He makes his solo recordings. And, you know, I think he's brilliant.
He is. And you weren't kidding about Sean. Sean's been on the show before, and man, she was a sweetheart.
Oh, I love. Total love. Beautiful, sexy, incredible on stage. Yeah, everybody loved Sean on stage.
On to another favorite of the show, Kurt Vanderhoof's been on here a couple of times. Mike Howe is actually one of my my favorite guests on here too. But Metal Church, they're actually kind of getting maybe a little bit more due now than they did back then with, you know, even Stone Sour covering them and kind of everybody talking about how much they love Metal Church. But yeah, Metal Church, one of my favorite all-time bands. And what, you know, what drew you to them?
They had a young manager named Willie in Seattle. And Willie sent me their independent release. And I heard the release and I fell in love with it. And I think at one point I went to Seattle to see them. And I thought they were great. They had a fabulous singer named Dave Wayne, extraordinary vocalist, and just this fun-loving person. And then, of course, I meet Kurt, whose band it kind of sort of really is. He writes all the material and the music, and we became fast friends. And I thought, you know what? These guys deserve a chance. So I signed them to Elektra. And, you know, then we actually then made their next record called The Dark, and we made it with a producer from the UK named Mark Dodson, who I had heard some previous recordings of his, productions of his, and I thought, oh, this guy really gets it. And we made this really slick, fantastic record with them. You know, unfortunately, then we never achieved that kind of success that we did with Metallica. But they were fabulous, and I wanted them to stay in my life. At one point, I knew I was leaving Elektra to go to Geffen, so I believe they made one more record with Elektra, and Mike Howe is now starting to sing for them. What record did they make? Help me out.
Blessing in Disguise.
Blessing in Disguise, that's right. A great record. And then, you know, as time went on, I think for a bit of time they didn't perform, and now they're almost bigger than ever. And the acclaim is beautiful, because sometimes, like, you know, when we were talking about the Misfits, it's like, if you wait long enough, and people have loved you to begin with, they're so happy to have you back. So, you know, Kurt is constantly in his bedroom making music and making albums. And I think they're going back on the road again any minute. I saw some social media and posts in my news feed yesterday, but I didn't stare at it because I had other things going on. But I think they, you know, they have a new release out, or like some kind of special, like greatest hits release. I'll know more when I look at it.
I think,
but
it's, yeah, B-sides. Yeah, a little B-sides.
And yes, there's always people changing in the band. But, you know, the steadies are Mike Howe and Kurt Vanderhoof. And they're wonderful. And they're another band that I try and go see every time they play.
We'll finish up on the band side of it with, you got involved with Michael Graves' era Misfits, and that American Psycho album, I was listening to it. That's another one I was getting ready to talk to you listening to.
Okay.
I don't know why Michael Graves gets so much hate in these, like,
because he's a pain in the ass.
Well, he might be a pain in the ass, but that album is fantastic. So yes,
the record is superb. You know, I knew that they were also label-less, and that Michael was just getting, was just joining the band. And I had a number of meetings with Jerry Only. And I just thought, you know what? I've loved the Misfits since like 83. I'm in a position now at Geffen that I could sign them. I heard lots of the new material, and I thought, you know what? I got to sign these guys. So once again, I called upon Andy Wallace, but Daniel Ray, who is a dear friend of mine, like I said, worked with a lot of other bands, wanted to produce them. So Daniel Ray produced that album, and Andy Wallace mixed that record. And it's a great record. It's really a great, great record. I don't know what else to say about it.
Yeah, it was a good one, man. I got to, that was actually one of those 90s shows I got to open. I got to open for that version of the Misfits, so there we go.
Oh, how great. Oh, right?
And one friend of the show, and one of my favorite bands of all time, Life of Agony, Mina Caputo, and
yes,
and her, you know, coming out and transitioning, mm-hmm, and kind of being, mm-hmm, the face of this LGBT movement, and
yes,
metal fans, not all of them, but most are embracing everything. And, you know, to see that happening now in 2020, in the 2000s.
It's called progress.
There we go.
Listen, well, it's extraordinary. Mina and I have been friends for at least 25 years. I had been going to see Life of Agony way back in the day. At some point, I don't remember the year, maybe, when did I make that Brandy Duval, that Died Laughing record? In any, maybe in 99, the solo recording she wanted to make, still as Keith. But, you know, she was uncomfortable in her body, and it wasn't feeling right anymore, and she told me she wanted to transition. And of course, at some point, worried about what that crowd would think. And I said, hon, you know what? You just got to move forward, continue to be who you are and who you want to be, because in who you want to be, you will become the best person that you can be. And you know what? She started those shows at some point as Mina. The crowd literally embraced her, and here we are. Life is good. Also one of my all-time favorite bands.
Oh, such a
great
band.
Not because she's like my bestie, but no, we talk, we FaceTime every morning.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. She was a guest on the show a couple of years ago, and
wonderful.
It was definitely great to see them doing, mm-hmm, stuff. And Alan, mm-hmm, and Joey Z, you know, everybody's been on the show at some
crazy
point.
They're wonderful people, and I love that they have this new drummer in the band, because she really kicks ass. You know, she's really wonderful. So everything's good. You know, with most of the people that I know. Everything is good. We're all moving forward. We're all having a good time. We all feel blessed, and they feel blessed that they can play rock and roll and do their thing. And I feel blessed that my movie just got picked up on Netflix for a third year, and that catapulted itself into getting a book deal. And my book comes out March 31st. And, you know, it's like, I don't know what to say except life, thank God, and life is good.
Well, I typically ask, you know, producers and people in yes. your position, you know, who was yes. the kind of the one band that you didn't get to work with? And from what I can take away, that band would be Slayer for you.
Absolutely. Love them. Love Slayer. You know, for me, they are one of those bands like Metallica or that are one of a kind. They're no bullshit, no nonsense, and nobody sounds like them. It's the same thing. Like, you know, people are like, well, a lot of A&R guys wanted their version of Metallica. Well, that doesn't happen. You know, there's when somebody is that unique, like Metallica or Slayer, they just do what they do, and then everybody else copies or borrows or wants to be like them. But in the end, everybody just winds up doing their thing. And if their thing is any good to begin with, maybe they can move forward into greatness. But yes, Slayer, I've always loved. I have no idea really why I didn't wind up working with them. But, you know, to this day, I've been a huge fan. I go to all the shows. Gary Holt is a dear friend of mine. And I don't know what copy of the book you got, but on the back of the book, he writes a beautiful blurb.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so
fantastic.
There you go.
Well, speaking of the book, not only do you get Slayer, you get some Metal Church, you get some Mina Caputo, you get, you know, porn stars with 10 and a half inch penises, and
that's correct.
Prison pen pals and amputee photography, and yeah,
yes.
it's a fun read. And like I said, I've kind of powered through it, and I couldn't put it down.
Well, thank you very much.
And just once again, Michael Alago, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you so very much for calling. And I'm so glad I could be of help here. It's always great talking about those artists that I've worked with and continue sometimes to work with some of them, like a Cyndi Lauper. So anyway, thank you very much.
All right, huge thank you to Michael Alago today for taking some time talking to us over here at the Talk To Me podcast. If you enjoyed the interview, I would appreciate a nice rating, nice review over on iTunes, on Apple Podcasts, wherever you leave a nice rating and review. And if you'd like a Talk To Me t-shirt, make sure to reach out to me. $25, free shipping in the continental United States. Let's get these things out of my house and onto your body. So for the Talk To Me podcast, I am Joshua Toomey, and I will talk to you guys soon.